Oops, welcome to Change Narratives.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for making time to do this. We know you're working, so feel free to flex and show us what you do.
Aww.
So at Change Narratives today, we're doing something slightly different. We're going to be spending a day in the life of Uba, Thomas Uba. We're going to see what he does. And most importantly, he's going to be describing how he does what he does. So Uba, please introduce yourself to everyone that doesn't know you.
Thank you, Dumebi. It is a pleasure to be here. I mean, I told you I was shocked when you called me. But yeah, my name is Uba, Thomas Uba. I am a senior social protection specialist with the Social Protection and Labor Unit of the World Bank. I am currently based in the Abuja Country Office. Anything else they would like to know?
Okay, I mean, how would you describe what you do to a family member or a friend that doesn't work in the development sector? What is social protection?
That is a very interesting question, one that I have tried to answer over the last couple of years as dumb as possible. So, look, social protection is not one thing. I don't think there's a singular definition for it. So I'll probably just describe what social protection is for, how it basically impacts the lives of people. So social protection, if we're using a bit of jargon, is a combination of policies, frameworks, and programs that is specifically targeted at helping poor, vulnerable, economically insecure individuals and households, and securing them from, you know, risks, which include economic risks like poverty, welfare, but also health type risks, climate risks. I wouldn't throw in security risks, but like the impact of security. So you're thinking of nutrition, attending school, accessing services, including financial inclusion. So social protection is all that and more, you know, for poor people. So the idea behind social protection is to ensure that, you know, individuals who are poor are helped to be able to cushion whatever effect of their minimal welfare on their selves and their households.
Mm-hmm.
To help them, help promote them out of that poverty. So it introduces them to programs such as livelihood programs, skills building programs, etc. But also provides a safety net so that for those who are not necessarily poor but are vulnerable to, you know, crises, there can be a safety net, you know, to prevent them from falling into. No. So that is what social protection is. I hope it is.
No, honestly, because simple. Even though I work in the sector, right, I think that's the best definition of social protection I've actually ever heard.
Thank you.
So thank you for teaching me, because usually you talk about, oh, how there are sort of programs, but you were able to link everything together, programs, policies, and all of that. But you mentioned something very important. You mentioned people in poverty. You mentioned marginalized groups and all of that.
Correct.
And I was just wondering, does this have anything to do with COVID? Is there a specific role, let's say, social protection played with COVID?
Fantastic. So everyone, you know, when we had discussion about COVID, you see a health scare.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically a pandemic. But then the pandemic led to a lot of things. I think we are still reeling from the effects of that. Most of those effects were not just health, but economic in nature. I'll use one specific example, the lockdowns. So in our context here in Nigeria, when you're driving on the streets, you see a lot of road hawkers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People, and that is their daily livelihood. You know, what they sell is what, you know, they live on, basically. the moment the lockdown happens, all those individuals suddenly lost their livelihood, and they had to cope in, you know, a certain way. So in cases like that, social protection steps in with a safety net measure to say, okay, you know, we are locking down people's movements, which means you don't have customers to sell mm-hmm. to. But a safety net, sometimes in the form of a cash transfer, sometimes in the form of, you know, food interventions, etc.,
mm-hmm.
Can help those people cope with that lockdown.
Yeah.
So they're maybe earning 20,000-30,000 every month, 50,000 every month. The government can step in and say, okay, we're locking down for 2 months, which means you're not going to earn 100,000 during that period. We'll cushion that. We'll give you 100,000, 60,000, 80,000. So that's how social protection helps, you know, during times of economic jargon, shock. Economic shock.
Yeah.
But specifically for the COVID, during the COVID discussion, when the mm-hmm. lockdown happens, the government swung in and we supported the government, you know, to help with those kind of interventions. So, and it's something similar with the crisis happening now with the, you know, subsidy reform.
Yes.
Cost yes. of everything has gone up. So you find households who were earning 50,000 monthly and they were getting by, not doing excellently, but suddenly 15,000 is the equivalent of 5,000 to them.
Okay.
So you want to cushion that with a safety net so that they don't fall into poverty or take up negative coping mechanisms. So you find people selling land. That's a negative coping mechanism because the land is an asset. You want yeah. to, you want them to keep hold on to that as long as possible.
Yes.
So if you can provide a safety net for them to prevent that land sale, that's what social protection really does in times like
that's
that.
That's actually amazing. You're a superhero in your own right. So I was just wondering, was there ever a moment in your life that you knew that this is something you're going to do, this is something you have to do? What's the best way to describe it? Is this something you have to do, or something you're going to do, or something you ended up doing?
That is an interesting question. I say it's interesting because I think for me, life happens quite flexibly. I know planning, I've spoken to a lot of people who are life coaches and all, and they're like, oh, you know, you have to plan, set goals.
Yeah.
And now that is great. But the simple answer to that question is I didn't see myself here 10 years ago. I had a very totally different plan. So my background is tech. That's my training from university, computer engineer. When I came out of school,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was building software and writing code. All that was very, very
tech
interesting.
Bro.
Yes. So I am a tech bro, but I don't think it was sufficient for me.
Yeah.
For me, engineering really was about how do you apply that to solve problems.
Yes.
So my first take at tech was really to help build wealth
mm-hmm.
for small and medium scale enterprises.
Yeah.
Like this was like a long time ago, maybe like two lifetimes ago, maybe. But that was how I, you know, approached professional life,
mm-hmm.
but also personal life. You know, I have to apply myself, knowledge, apply it to solve a problem, to impact someone. So that's kind of like my philosophy. The private sector is great. There's a lot of money there. But sometimes I lose sight of the impact that
yeah.
it gives. And then you become, oh, it's about profit, because again, there
is
the bottom line that you have to contend with. You know, you have to worry about expenses, expenditures, etc. So I sort of evolved for that from there into the broader development sector, and I was doing innovation management, and sort of that was the long journey that led me to this point where my work really as a social protection specialist is to ensure that everything I've described previously on the social protection programs mm-hmm. is delivered properly.
Yes.
Using, you know, auditable digital systems that people can trust. Because, again, coming back to our context in Nigeria where, you know, you work with the government on anything, mm-hmm. there's a certain
mistrust
that comes with it. So my focus was, okay, how can I leverage what I know to achieve these goals, to ensure that impact gets to the people, and then there's a narrative around there that says, if you don't trust it, you can come verify for yourself. So yeah. No, I do not see myself here, but yes, it's sort of like a journey that has sort of led me here, and it's how I just keep applying myself to.
It's also very nice how you've answered a lot of the other questions I have, because, you know, I've seen you do your work and I see how you're able to, you know, move your skills towards cross-cutting things in the bank. And, you know, I was going to say something about adaptability. The fact that I feel the labor market has changed so much that you now have to be so adaptable. Like, imagine you coming from the tech sector into social protection, and then seeing the intersection between both sectors.
Yeah.
And you have one goal, which I believe everyone, to be honest, has a common goal, which is solving problems. So whether you're running a business or you're working in the development sector, you're trying to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And then you were able to, you know, build a system around all of this. So what would you say are the main skills you're able to transfer from the tech sector into the development sector?
The first main skill is the problem-solving skill. So when people think of software development especially, they think, oh, you know, someone behind a computer looking at multiple screens, cup of coffee or cup of coke with a whole bunch of half-eaten donuts.
Typing away.
Yeah. No, but really, software development is really about problem solving. In fact, there was a time where it was called solutions development. You know, you're developing solutions for people. So the one thing you have to learn is that when you see a problem, you have to first solve it, then develop an algorithm to automate the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can code.
Yes.
So there is that skill of mm-hmm. ability to critically look at things and analyze and solve. Then the whole idea of program or project management comes into play, because you have a goal, you have a start point. Mm-hmm. Getting between the start point and the goal involves a couple of steps. And it can be, you know, flexible like the agile methodology, or straightforward like the watershed methodology. But you take all those things into play, realizing that, okay, there you have to come up with that plan, timelines, specific deliverables, etc. But also the flexibility that when you meet, you know, not a dead end, but a challenge, you have to surmount it. Sometimes that entails also stepping back. So solving problems, program management, actually the adaptability. I think I mentioned this, but specifically ability to analyze, which helps with this, you know, the problem solving.
Yes.
I think those skills definitely were one of, you know, the skills that, you know, were transferable. Then one thing definitely I brought in is great personality.
Yeah, actually, you're one of the most fun people at the office.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, anytime you're not around, it's weird.
Sorry.
I'm not even trying to flatter you, but honestly, you should know. So when you come back to listen to this again, you remember that I said it, and okay. It was me that said it. You mentioned something about problem solving.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to work with the government, is there a time that, you know, political will and all of that stands in the way of the work you're trying to do? And some of even these new systems you've introduced to build trust. So is there a way, or is there something you apply in terms of problem solving to some of these barriers you can see in your work from the government?
Hmm. So I think, okay, not I think, based on what I have done so far and working with government, because I mean, you are with the bank and you know that our work is really with the government. We only really do support, personal training, and in the kitchen support. Yeah, we are not the cooks, you know, we are not the, but we work with them side by side. What I'll say is political will is definitely not an exact science.
Mm-hmm.
It is not. It is it's a bull that I think I am still learning to wrangle.
Yeah.
And when you speak about political will, it's twin. Well, yeah, I'll call it it's twin. Vested interest is not so far away. And in terms of really how you navigate those two, you know, meandering waters that can be very turbulent, is really about one, contextual understanding. So you have to understand the context you're dealing with.
Yes.
Then you have to have a reasonable amount of emotional intelligence, I think. Because you have to pick up cues. What are they saying that they are not really saying or putting into words?
Okay. So, well, my question to you is how you're able to handle some of the political barriers you may face in your work. So you mentioned things about managing trust, building trust, problem solving, and all of that. And I believe, you know, political will in itself is a problem. How do you address this?
Okay, again, great question. As you can see, I'm itching my head because I'm trying to sort of pull out the answer.
Yeah.
So when I think of political will, the first thing I'll say, it's not an exact science because it has to do with personalities, right? And personalities vary. But you know, when you start talking about political will, the one thing that comes to the fore immediately is vested interests.
Yes.
That immediately comes up. And to really get what we want in terms of political will, you have to understand the vested interest. And a lot of times understanding the vested interest, because vested interests are never explicitly stated. A lot of times it's
in between the lines.
First takes a lot of understanding and reading between the lines to really know what, you know, what interests are being, you know, portrayed. Mm-hmm. Because they are never explicitly explicitly stated. And to, I think, to be really successful in navigating those two twin storms of political will and vested interest, you really have to now understand a bit of the context. Well, not a bit, a lot of the context. Whether it is political, social, even religious sometimes, you need to understand how those things relate and, you know, interplay.
Mm-hmm.
But one key thing that I've realized is, okay, two things. So one, there's the emotional intelligence. But one tool in my toolbox that I always bring out to use is also a sense of humility. Right? It's always very key. So I work in an institution that prides itself as a knowledge bank. So sometimes I like to refer to it as the ITK in the room. For those who do not know what ITK is I to know.
Yes, it means that you know too much.
You know too much.
And you want everybody to know
that
you know.
Correct. So the bank can be like that. And a lot of times, that doesn't solve problems. It just, you go to, I mean, many times I've gone for meetings and you come out and then you just realize that, you know, all that has happened in that meeting is that people just try to prove to themselves that they know. But no solution has come up.
So what's being humble? You show them that you don't know, or you're willing to learn?
So yes, so there's the willingness to learn, because for everyone you are speaking to, there is a bit of wisdom that they have to bring to the table.
Yes.
Whether it be experience, a knowledge of a system they work with that you do not work with. And you need to be able to, you know, engage at that level.
Yes.
So I have experienced that once you engage at that level, mm-hmm. they're also willing to listen to you.
Yes.
And at that point in time, you now start understanding better, okay, these are your interests. This is what you define as a win.
Yes.
So when I say vested interest, it doesn't have to be clandestine. It just has to be, for me, a win is this. That is a vested interest, you know. So how do they define their wins? And a lot of times, their wins are not necessarily negative. Then you take your goal and say, okay, I can align this goal with your win. And the moment those two things meet, political will is born.
That's very insightful. Because like you've worked in the sector for a long time, and you know, everybody would always say, like when you think of a problem you want to solve across Africa, mm-hmm. In the course of my fellowship, when as fellows we were discussing, we'd be like, the government. But being able to look at it like this, you know, gives a lot of insight on how to address problems. So let's say now we've addressed the issue of political will. What would you say comes first when you're trying to build or decide on a program? Would you say it's the people? Would you say it's the data or the policy, and why?
First, the people.
People.
Always. So maybe I should have mentioned this, but one of the things that you learn when building a tech product is this, you know, idea called human-centered design. I learned it quite a few years ago when I was actually beginning to look into tech for social protection. So there's human-centered design, but it's an old product game book. That's mm-hmm. where it comes from.
Yeah.
You know, you are building a product. You need to know who your customer is first. So you build a customer profile and all that, and then you build a product to match that customer.
Yeah.
And if another customer profile comes, you build another product to match that customer.
Mm-hmm.
So first, the people.
Yes.
That's always, you know,
The main thing.
And the reason is when you put the people first, you're able to profile them. So you can say, okay, the people I want to target are, or the people I want to reach are women
mm-hmm.
that are pregnant. People I want to reach are children that are out of school. And then when you answer the question about who they are, then you answer the question, then you try to ask the question of why are they here? And then when you try to answer the why are they here, then the policies come in.
Yeah.
You know, they say, okay, they are here because the children are out of school because they are poor, or their parents are poor, or they are orphans, or there's no school within 50 kilometers of their residence or their village. And then you realize that, okay, that's why they are there. And then you come up with the programs of, okay, we need to give them, you know, cash transfers to help cushion the effect of monetary poverty. Let's build a school in their community so that they can walk to school 15 minutes and not have to worry about insecurity between their house and a school 50 kilometers away.
Yeah.
You know, and then you say, okay, we need to, maybe if the challenge is, they don't like the teachers in the school. Let's train people in your community to become teachers. You know.
Maybe they can relate to them better.
Exactly. And it is when you answer those questions that I now consider the very last thing, financing, which is, so how do you now pay for this? Because there is no free lunch. Everything costs money.
Yes.
Everything. Every single thing costs, well, not only money, but costs something.
Yeah.
Most of the time, the lowest cost denominator we can find is money. So we always try to translate that to money. So So yeah, the people, definitely, then policies, programs, and then financing.
Yeah, and then you've actually worked across a lot of projects. And I like to think that people in your position will have a flow, you know, especially where you talk about people, because mm-hmm. I'm so happy you mentioned people, mm-hmm. you know, when I was asking about people, data, and policy.
Yeah.
So how would you say your flow is? Like, how do you have a system, a specific system? How do you find the people? How do you confirm, you know, the identity or the demographics they represent? How do you deliver support? How do you handle complaints? Like, is this, just walk me through your flow. So let's say you have a system, which I want to believe that you do. What exactly is your flow? Flow.
Ah, flow. So I was going to answer by saying I usually leave that to the smarter people.
There are people smarter than you.
Oh.
I didn't know.
So one of my biggest secrets is that I'm never the smartest person in the room. You know, I go in and then I allow the smart people speak and then I agree to everything they say. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, yes, yes, yes. And then I repeat it and then I sound smart by repeating what they said.
Okay.
I think, so in terms of flow, I'm a very, very fluid person. And I've been trying to convince myself that I need to change that, but I've learned that it's just how I am. I don't know how to plan and be rigid and stick to the plan. You know, for every time I tried that, I failed woefully. So the one thing in terms of flow, if that's what I would call it, is I always try to answer the, okay, where am I headed?
Yeah.
This is where I'm going to. So the people, right? I need to know that. So let's use a poverty program as an example.
Okay.
So in the bank, I lead a safety net program, supporting cash transfers to poor households. Two questions that I answered is, one, who are these people? And two, how did they receive this benefit?
Yeah.
So the first question, who are these people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the answer is shock-affected people, but then that's quite vague. What do you mean by shock-affected people? And this is where you now have to realize that you are one person, but you have access to team resources. So you can't achieve success without the strength of the team, right? Which is why I say, I let the smarter people handle it.
Okay.
But the team gives you access to not just people resources, but also data that, you know, helps you fine tune every answer to every question that you've initially had. So that is how we answered, you know, who these people are. So we built a profile. They are this, within this income bracket, likely in these locations. And then some smart people within the team will bring in AI and say, oh, we can use AI to further refine this using this data. You know, so we answer that. Then the next one you answer is, okay, what do we need to do fieldwork-wise to be able to identify these people? And okay, who do we need to engage with? You do that, you do the field work, you do the stakeholder engagement. So you are talking about everything from village chiefs to other community groups, women, yeah, youth, men, you know, religious, but also government stakeholders. So the NIMC, that's the National Identity Management Commission, that deals with the foundational ID for people. The central bank and the various financial
systems,
service yeah, providers and payment system providers, you get to deal with them. So banks, system spec remitter, you know, and you get to deal with them. And then you connect all those systems.